What's up? Welcome to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. We are broadcasting live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. You need forklifts that perform under pressure and pallet racking that maximizes your space. Visit them online at racksteel.com. I should mention, of course, Drance also covers the team for The Athletic. What's going on, man?
Well, first of all, game one.
Fantastic.
Woo!
Fantastic.
We are in a real purple patch of
I love it.
Quality hockey across the last 7-8 months.
You're trying on your BBC soccer.
I just think the quality of hockey right now in the NHL, especially when these two teams are playing, or when we saw Canada USA, or when we saw the Winnipeg comeback and the Rantanen nuke show, the same weekend in that first round. I think moments in that LA Edmonton series were absolutely thrilling. You know, the conference finals were a bit of a letdown, but that Toronto Florida series was dramatic, was fun, had major storylines. I just think the amount that I'm enjoying watching hockey every night right now is through the roof.
It was a great product.
And I also watched a lot of Canucks this season.
It was a great product last night. There's no way around it. You didn't even mention like the comeback Winnipeg win in game 7 against St. Louis. Like, that was an incredible moment. I mean, it's way back in round one now, but just for pure kind of hockey viewing, that was incredible.
Even that entire St. Louis win streak.
Yeah.
You know, like the playoff race, I know the Canucks ended up falling out of it, so people probably don't regard it fondly, but there were nights there where St. Louis was just winning every night, and you know, you sort of had to watch it, and then you got that like awesome Canucks game against the Rangers, and then that Canucks game against the Columbus Blue Jackets on that Friday night, you know what I mean? And it was all interspersed. It was like every night going home, looking forward to watching those games. The playoff race in the East, what Montreal was able to do down the stretch, what Ottawa was able to do down the stretch, the way that Columbus played all year, you know, the way that Utah played all year. I mean, you had non-playoff teams that were legitimately like controlling play and blowing teams out. Because they've got a lot of sick young talent that sort of came together, and it wasn't quite enough, but they're going to be interesting to watch next year. I just feel like the talent level, the speed, the way that teams are playing tactically, we're in such a good spot hockey-wise. The NHL is in such a good spot product-wise. You know, and one thing I'd add is like titanic clash between rivals that contested the Stanley Cup final last year and are now having a sequel, a rematch. It's like a very NBA-ass final.
Yes, yeah, and that's a good way of looking at it, yeah.
And meanwhile, in the NBA, you've got this Indiana-Oklahoma City Thunder matchup that feels very NHL.
Yep.
Right? So, I mean, I've been talking about this flippening between the NHL becoming more tilted toward the best of the best and the NBA becoming more random in terms of outcomes. And I think that's happened now. I think where I was seeing trend lines, I now think these two leagues are really meeting in the middle. The implications for storylines and fan enjoyment are through the roof. And like, that's an opportunity. This is a moment for the league. Like, this is one of the most lopsided NBA betting finals.
Yes.
This is expected to be a coronation. It may not be, but this is expected to be something of a coronation. The markets are small. The ratings are going to be low. You know, meanwhile, the NBA has McDavid against the Florida Panthers, Matthew Tkachuk and the Florida Panthers in the Stanley Cup final. Like, this feels like a moment for the league. I'll be honest with you. Maybe the first big one on the national stage from a U.S. consciousness perspective since 1994.
And you hope it lives up to that, right? And I mean, that's the famous
Game One did.
That's the famous Sports Illustrated cover time there. But yeah, Game One did. You hope it continues to live up to that hype and that potential to be that sort of moment. Before we really dig into Game One and what we saw, by the way,
news?
Michael Russo from The Athletic, who's on site covering the Stanley Cup, he'll join us at 12:30. But also a great chance to chat with Russo about the Minnesota Wild and Marco Rossi and what might happen there this summer, because of course that's a team he regularly covers for The Athletic. So we'll chat with Michael Russo at 12:30. We were going to have Mark Spector on, and I know all our listeners will be devastated.
I'm actually devastated.
That he had to reschedule to tomorrow.
Mark
Spector
rocks.
But we will have Spector on. We will have Spector on tomorrow. Anyways, before we get to all that, the Canucks, just before we came on the air, announced some coaching staff news. So first of all, they confirm your report from earlier in the week, naming Kevin Dean an assistant coach. Also,
I wasn't sweating it.
Rounding out the staff, Brett McLean and Scott Young. Now, Scott Young had previously been in a player development role role with the Canucks. And I know you've talked in the past about his expertise, his skill in relationship building and scouting, especially in the eastern part of the United States. Now he becomes an assistant coach. So Kevin Dean, Brett McLean, Scott Young will be Adam Foote's assistant coaches. The team also announced that assistant coach Yogi Shevkovsky, and this was made official by the Philadelphia Flyers earlier this morning, defensive development coach Sergei Gonchar and video coach Dylan Crawford will not be returning to the team for the 2025-26 season. The other people on the kind of periphery of the coaching staff that remain in place, Marco Terenius as the goalie coach, the Sedin twins, and Jason Krog as well. So the big news there, Brett McLean, Kevin Dean, Scott Young will be Adam Foote's assistant coaches next year.
Yeah, so Scott Young, I mean, the issue with the Scott Young aspect of this, just to start there, is I think he's a really gifted talent evaluator. I mean, some of his pulls from his time with the Penguins organization are... A, on the Canucks now, Drew O'Connor being like,
yes,
top of the line. I mean, that was a guy like, how much did we talk about this when the Canucks acquired Drew O'Connor? Just how odd his late
path
bloomer
is,
path
a little
is.
Bit. Just a little bit, not much, but a little bit.
I mean, that's an incredible pull to get a real NHL player and not just a real NHL player, but an NHL player with like plus speed and size.
Mm-hmm.
Given his background out of Dartmouth the way they did, you know, that's sort of a Scott Young special and go through that sort of time, his time in the Penguins organization is just a ton of hits brought in. And a lot of good work in terms of like jockeying to get guys, knowing guys, having those relationships.
Yes.
Those might not pay off right away either, right? You might not even win the bidding for the guy, but if they hit group five, if they hit whatever, right? That those relationships matter. The intel matters in terms of
trade targets down the road, 100%. Right? Who we might be interested in. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, not that he won't be involved necessarily, not that Jim Rutherford can't call him up and ask his opinion on whatever if he's an assistant coach, but, you know, his attention, he's not going to be in rinks in Massachusetts the way that he would have been normally, right? He's not going to be watching American League hockey and sort of contributing on that side of the ledger, the evaluation, talent evaluation ledger. And I do think that's a loss because I think he knows what he's doing. I think he's a very, very bright guy. Now, that said, I think he's a very, very bright guy.
Yeah,
so he
great,
can be a
good to have a bright hockey guy on your bench as well.
Totally.
Right? Yeah.
But you are, you know, it's like, let's move Pugh Suter to third line center to stabilize the third line. It's like, okay, but now our first line's not as good defensively without him on the wing.
Sure.
Game,
yeah.
Right. Like that's kind of what we're talking about here with Scott Young. Brett McLean is the most experienced member of this staff. He's been an American League head coach for 2 years. He's been in the Wild organization for a while. You know, you remember him as a player, relatively anonymous Coyotes player in my mind, I still think of. But yeah, I mean, interesting. I'll do a little bit more work on that. But obviously there'd be some organizational familiarity with him, just given that he's been a sort of longstanding member of Bill Guerin's staff. Right.
Yes.
That connective tissue presumably matters a bit. But yeah, I mean, so that's the power play coach here. Right. And then you've got Dean.
Yeah.
Running the defense, and Dean's an old hand assistant coach who's got a couple years of professional experience as head coach. I think there's sort of two takeaways. I mean, all of this makes sense. All of these seem like good hires. The concern I think that makes sense to note is between Young, who's never been a professional coach,
mm-hmm.
right? NCAA level only. Between McLean, who's got 2 years of head coaching experience at the pro level, and between, the other guy would be Kevin Dean, who has 2 years of experience as a head coach at the professional level, one in the ECHL, one in the AHL, and Adam Foote, who's never been a professional head coach. Like, there is a lot of inexperience on this bench, probably more so than there is for any NHL team, to be totally honest with
you. Now, one other thing to note about Scott Young, and it's well, he's going to run the forwards, how I understand it. I want to just get back to that in a second. But you've talked about the importance of the head coach having their guy. And it does note Scott Young won a Stanley Cup with Adam Foote as a member of
there
the Colorado Avalanche. And Foote checks that, saying they have a long history and share a very strong bond. So
there you go.
That's his guy.
I think
we can surmise, right? That's the guy that he can lean on, that he can really go to, and has that pre-built-in relationship.
And so that makes sense, right?
Yeah.
I think that makes more sense to me pretty suddenly here.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't know where Dean and Rutherford necessarily would have crossed paths, but I think there's a relationship there. So it would make sense if Dean was, you know, not Rutherford's guy, but and Rutherford doesn't do the you get one, I get one.
Right.
That's not how this coaching staff gets filled out, at least from the president's point of view. But yeah, so you've got Kevin Dean in. Then you've, as sort of the defensive coach, there's a relationship there for sure between him and Jim Rutherford. You've got the power play specialist coach in Brett McLean, and then you've got Foots guy. That makes sense to me as a composition.
Yeah. Yeah, so those are the hires, Brett McLean, Scott Young. Hopefully we can get Kevin Dean as well. Hopefully we can get one or maybe all of them on the station at various points here in the next little while, and we'll learn more about how this coaching staff is going to function, what it's going to look like. Again, Kevin Dean running the defense, Brett McLean in charge of the power play, and Scott Young on the forward side. And I just want to note, this was a great example of why I could never be a successful insider in the NHL, because I actually got a text. I'm not going to say from who, but a text tipping me off to this, to these hires about 15 minutes before it was announced, being like, hey, just so you know, if you want to run with this, this is coming in about 15 minutes. And I just didn't check my phone. And then I checked my phone after it had been announced. I was like, oh, that would have been cool. That would have been a good thing to do.
Yikes.
So there you go. My career as an insider coming to a very, very swift end.
Sorry, Keith texted in. People had no issue with Malhotra being a rookie. We talked about it a lot.
That's true.
We talked about it ad nauseum because the Canucks had sort of downgraded experience-wise from Jeremy Colleton, who was a top American League head coach. And we brought that up regularly in talking about the composition of the Canucks coaching staff, especially in the context, too, of Mike Yeo's departure. Right. And the idea that the Canucks had decided not to spend significantly on their coaching staff. So, no, the truth is that I think experience matters a ton in coaching. It doesn't always, if you land the right smart guy, as Malhotra has proven. Right. That team's one win away after last night from the Calder Cup final.
Yes.
So any concerns about Malhotra's experience, while fair, were unfounded based on his performance in year one. So it's not to say that experience matters in terms of actually shaping outcomes, provided
it can matter.
But it doesn't matter.
It's not the determining factor.
It doesn't matter if you land the right guy. Like,
yeah,
it doesn't
exactly.
matter if you
yeah.
land, if it doesn't matter if you're right, but it's a fair thing to bring up, because at least to some, like, the NHL is not a rookie league, man.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the NHL is not a rookie league at any level. Like, equipment manager, PR guy, like, the seams will show if you don't have experience, if you haven't been through the cycle. And it's little things. Like, a head coach has to be the metronome, the predictable metronome. There's a lot of scheduling. There's daily media briefings. There's a lot of, like, executive capacity functions outside the performance of the hockey team that demand a lot of time and attention. And, like, just that workload. I remember hearing about it from Canucks staffers, for example, when they moved from Tortorella, who's like the NHL head coach, right? Mm-hmm. Like, knows exactly what life is like in the NHL and knows exactly sort of, you know, whether you like his performance, the performance of his teams or the style he plays or his line combinations or any of the hockey stuff, in terms of like scheduling a team and that executive capacity stuff. He's nails at that. He's done that. He does that in his sleep. Moving from him to Willie Desjardins, who'd never done it and was effectively a junior coach, was like a massive eye opener for a lot of people. In part because, you know, everyone in the organization at the time had worked for so long under Crawford and Vigneault. The club had only had two head coaches across 12 years. And when Willie Desjardins came in, it was like, whoa, we've got a lot of work to do. From a support staffer's perspective, just in terms of navigating the day-to-day with a coach who didn't really know what the rhythms of life in the NHL were like. So it's a huge factor.
By the way, Adam Foote is going to do a Zoom media conference at 12:45 today, and I believe we are going to take it live. So we'll chat with Michael Russo at 12:30 for about 10 or 15 minutes, and then we'll go to Adam Foote and hear what he has to say about these latest coaching additions to his staff. Okay, before we move on from the Canucks organization here, as you mentioned, Abbotsford Canucks wins game four of the Calder Cup Western Conference Finals last night, thanks to a frankly sensational Danila Klimovich double overtime goal. 5-4 is the final in that one. So they now take a 3-1 series lead. One more game to go in Texas. That's game five, which is tomorrow at 5 Pacific time. If they don't clinch then, I believe game six and seven are back-to-back Sunday and Monday in Abbotsford. And one way or another, I also saw that the Calder Cup Finals And the Canucks not there yet, but they're on the brink. We'll start next Friday, June 13th. So 3-1, and again, just a ridiculous. If you haven't seen the highlight yet, go check out the Danila Klimovich double overtime goal that gave them the 5-4 win in that one. All right. So a lot going on today, a lot to come on the show, including we'll hear from Adam Foote, we'll chat with Michael Russo, but we talked about it just really briefly from an entertainment value perspective off the top. Edmonton takes game one of the Stanley Cup final. They beat Florida 4-3 thanks to a Leon Draisaitl power play goal late in the first overtime. And, I mean, as we said, look, this was just a super fun game to watch. You certainly got the sense that these were the two best teams going toe-to-toe. There was the emotion, the physicality, the skill, all of it. I want to start with one of the things that we were talking about yesterday in our preview, which was kind of the idea of the matchup between Florida's forecheck and Edmonton's ability to move the puck. And I thought Florida's forecheck did do a really good job, and they had moments where they were forcing those turnovers and generating scoring chances. The first Sam Bennett goal that was challenged but upheld, that came off a turnover they created off the forecheck. But what I thought was interesting was the best thing that Edmonton did to frustrate the forecheck, it wasn't their defense moving the puck effectively necessarily, although there were moments where they did that, but it was just that they were able to keep Florida from breaking out, and therefore Florida wasn't getting a chance to set up their forecheck through the neutral zone. It was one of those situations where the best way to neutralize Florida's forecheck, it turned out from Edmonton's perspective, was just don't give it a chance to even get in. Because when they did have chances, I thought they were really effective, but ultimately Edmonton did enough playing in Florida's end to just not give them that many opportunities to get after it.
Yeah, so I actually thought the Florida Panthers dictated play. Like, that game looked like, for the vast majority of the game, the series that the Florida Panthers wanted to look like.
When they had the chance to get their forecheck set up, it was really good. They just didn't get the chance to set it up all night.
I thought they got the chance to set it up all night. Honestly, I thought the...
No, there were stretches where Edmonton was forcing them just to chip it off the glass and out, and then they couldn't recover. And
well, that's what's going to happen. My point is their forecheck played, and more than that, Edmonton's good enough to pull off a game in which they're on their heels, right? But how many, I think you can count the number of times that the Oilers were able to leave their zone clean on two hands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was like 7 or 8. And by the way, every time they got out clean, they got a scoring chance.
Yes.
Every time they got out clean, it was like Kapanen takes Forsling out wide, or Bouchard takes Forsling out wide, or there's McDavid with a 2-on-1 chance, or, you know, there's Adam Henrique and Trent Frederick, and you know for sure that Trent Frederick's not going to score, right? I mean, that was what that game felt like. Every time the Oilers broke the Panthers' forecheck, there was space. And I felt like, honestly, that Bouchard chance in overtime was the perfect sort of emblematic example of the dare that the Florida Panthers force you in.
Mm-hmm.
It almost looked like a rugby play, in that the Oilers made like 3 area passes out to the left and then 2 finding the overlap back out right. And then Bouchard had room to move. You know what I mean? They broke through the line, and it was just like this stark relief once they did it. The Oilers force you to use the middle of the ice in the defensive zone on the breakout. It is brutally difficult to do. They will kill you if you mess it up. But, man, that is where the gold lies. That's how you have to break them. I actually don't think the Oilers did a great job of it. So the fact that the Oilers, in my opinion, didn't, at least until the last 15 minutes of the third, and they managed to get some rush chances in overtime, the fact that the Oilers didn't do a great job of playing their own game, of imposing their preferred tempo on the game, and still were able to claw back from a 3-1 deficit in the game and win in overtime, I think that's probably better news for Edmonton than it is good news that the Panthers' forecheck is going to play against the Oilers.
It's a massive missed opportunity for Florida. Like, even just being up 3-1, obviously, but as you said, you were getting your opportunities with the forecheck when it was there for you, but you just weren't able to make it count because you know Edmonton's going to have stronger games in the series. Not that they were poor by any means. They had some really great stretches in that game. I also just think, and I know everyone's talking about Leon Draisaitl. He scores the first goal, scores the winner, and, you know, he was such a shell of himself in the last finals, and that is a really, really big difference between this year and last year. But I also think, you know, when you think about the players in this series, right, beyond Connor McDavid, you got Leon Draisaitl, Matthew Tkachuk, Alexander Barkov, you know, Sam Reinhart, 50-goal scorer. You got so much star power in this series, and yet the degree to which Connor McDavid is clearly the best player on the ice, I thought, was just absurd. And, you know, you see now in this situation, right, where Knobloch's using him on the penalty kill, and he's an absolute menace. And you see the defensive back checks and everything. You see the speed, all of it, the way he sets up Ekholm, the way he sets up Dreisaitl for the winner. Like, he is so clearly a tier above even the other phenomenal players, even a guy like Leon Dreisaitl, who might be the second best player in the league and had a phenomenal game in his own right last night. Like, it was just a reminder of how incredibly special he is as a player and what a weapon that is, even in a matchup with some of the other elite players in the league.
Yeah, I mean, so this that was also the... Everyone's been talking about, like, what's different about this series than last year, and guess what? Dreisaitl's
a big thing. That's a big
Leon Dreisaitl's the biggest addition for the Oilers. Like, full body Leon Dreisaitl. Welcome to the party. You are a dog.
He's pretty incredible.
He's incredible. That first goal and the hit he takes from Forsling, mm-hmm. the fact that he sort of comes out of the corner in a battle against Forsling, one of the great defensive defenders of the last 3 years, and Matthew Tkachuk, who, by the way, was dialed in defensively. How many intercepts?
Yes.
How many?
He made some great plays.
He was incredible last night defensively. Actually, that Bennett line was incredible throughout the evening. But
we should talk about Sam Bennett at some point
for sure.
So good, man.
So the one where he fell over Kulak's skate,
so
clearly
good.
The comparison I made on the PDO cast, which I'll give to you too, is that was a moment because, you know, he meant to do it.
Yeah, of course.
But he meant to do it in such a way where there was nothing the referees could do without being like, you're a liar.
Yeah, so in the moment, I saw everyone else on Twitter was like, oh, that goal's definitely coming back. I was like, no, it's not.
I mean, it's clearly goaltender interference, and it's clear that Tkachuk fell over Kulak.
Bennett
fell over Kulak once he felt his skate touch him a little bit. He wasn't pushed into the goalie. He propelled himself down and into the goalie at exactly the right moment to disrupt
Stuart
Skinner.
But I still didn't think they were going to call it back because of the contact from Kulak.
Okay, but you know what the equivalent of this is? The equivalent is, like, for me watching that replay and seeing and beginning to understand the full scope of Sam Bennett's evil genius, I felt like I was Morgan Freeman opening the box at the end of Seven. You know where Morgan Freeman opens the box at the end of Seven, and then he radios to
what's in the box.
But first, he radios to the helicopters as he processes it all, right? And he says, "Stay away from here. You hear? Like, no matter what you hear, like, John Doe has the upper hand." It's like Sam Bennett has the upper hand. He is the master manipulator.
The wild thing about Sam Bennett too is because usually with pests, like, they're so good at playing on the edge and getting other people off their game and getting other people to lose their composure. But there's also an element of, like, they might lose their composure at any time. You know what I mean? Sam Bennett just seems so utterly calm and in control at all times. Like, he barely looks like he's breaking a sweat out there as he is causing absolute havoc at all times to the other team and getting in their heads. It's really just phenomenal to watch what he's doing in these playoffs, and just continues to pad his next contract should he choose to test UFA status. Okay, we will take a break. As I mentioned, Michael Russo will join us next. We'll get his thoughts on Game 1. Quickly, if we have time, we'll talk maybe a little Marco Rossi out of Minnesota and the State of the League address from Gary Bettman yesterday as well. Then we will go to Adam Foote, press conference, talking about his new coaching hires for the Canucks, rounding out his staff at 12:45. That's all next here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. We're live from the Kintech studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel has the expertise to get you operating faster with forklifts and pallet racking in stock. Visit them online at racksteel.com. And again, we are going to hear from Adam Foote in about 13 minutes' time. But first, calling in on the hotline powered by Power West Industries from The Athletic, covering the Minnesota Wild and the NHL generally. He's at the Stanley Cup. He is Michael Russo. Mike, thanks very much for doing this today. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing?
We're doing great. So, I mean, we both really enjoyed game one of the Stanley Cup final. Edmonton takes it. What do you think your kind of lasting number one takeaway is going to be from what we saw last night?
Yeah, that this is going to be a much harder series than Florida faced last year. I mean, you know, the biggest thing is that Dreisaitl's healthy. Kane is healthy. You know, remember Darnell Nurse got hurt in that series last year. He's healthy. And that you know, including their much improved depth over last year and the fact that I think they're a bigger, deeper team than last year, which I don't think a lot of us thought when they lost Broberg and Holloway. I think it's going to make this a very tough, a much tougher series in Florida. Florida always seems to figure out a way to respond, and I certainly think they're going to adjust. And that game obviously could have gone either way yesterday, but it was one exciting game. And clearly, I think Edmonton showed Florida that this is not going to be a simple task for them to repeat.
Mike, my impression of the game, honestly, was that Florida was able to dictate the terms of engagement in terms of, and I know you've been watching them play a lot this postseason, but in terms of their forecheck really playing and being felt all night long, I thought it did. Like, I thought that game looked a lot more like a game that the Florida Panthers have won all playoffs long than a game that the Edmonton Oilers have won all playoffs long. Maybe until the last 15 minutes of the third when the Oilers started to get loose on occasion off the rush. But for the most part, given that, I don't know if you agree, but okay, let's start there. Do you agree with me that the Panthers were kind of able to play their game despite the loss?
Yeah, I do. You know, I do think that in the first period, it was definitely an adjustment for them. I thought they got up to a real slow start, even though they had a lead. I mean, you know, they had, what, five shots through the end of the period, yet somehow had a lead. I thought the second period was by far their best period. Easily could have finished more, got a little loose there on the one shift that Arvidsson scored. It's probably a goal that Bob would want back. And then the third period really was all Edmonton. You know, first 10 minutes of overtime, it was all Florida. So I think it was an even game, but I agree with you. I don't think they had their way on the forecheck the way that they did against, at times, Toronto, and definitely at times against Carolina. But I think that you know, they made – what I was more shocked at is how loose they became on their breakouts at times and how just they had trouble getting out of the zone. You don't see them icing the puck nearly as much as they did yesterday. So I was really impressed at the fact that Edmonton was able to handle, after maybe a little bit of adjustment there in the second period going into the third, handle them much better than the previous three rounds that I saw them play.
What do you take from, like, so if we're basically on the same page that the Panthers were able to dictate some of the tempo, the fact that the Oilers were able to win despite that, did you sort of see that as a, you know, in the big picture of the series, is it a bad thing for Florida that their brand of jujitsu didn't work last night? Or is it a good thing that their brand of jujitsu was still shaping sort of the environment on the ice?
Yeah, I mean, I you know, the easy answer would be I'll tell you tomorrow night. I just think, which is my which is
work
my
smart.
Expertise.
I love it.
But you know, I guess here's the way I look at it. I've covered them, you know, because of my day job covering the Minnesota Wild. I've gotten to cover the Florida Panthers 3 years in a row on the postseason. You know, I cover a team that doesn't go on long playoff runs. So I've gotten to be around this team a lot. And I guess, you know, especially after covering those seven games last year against Edmonton, I guess the thing that would concern me if I was a Florida Panther today and certainly one of their fans is how many guys besides Dreisaitl and McDavid were great last night. Like, their fourth line, their Janmark line was outstanding. I thought Pekulzin,
Pekulzin
might have turned overtime around. Not just the fact that he pressured Noshik into the penalty, but if you remember, it was all Florida until all of a sudden he started hitting guys and pressured Aaron Ekblad into a really bad icing. And next thing you know, it just felt like Edmonton started turning overtime into a sequence where they were coming in waves. I thought Kasperi Kapanen yesterday was just sensational. You know, Corey Perry, again, he was a little wired there in the first period, probably a little too juiced up and took a couple penalties, but he just got better and better and obviously made the underrated pass to McDavid before the Dreisaitl goal. You know, the fact that Kulak and Wallman and John Klingberg continue to, you know, just have tremendous playoffs, I think this puts Florida into a position where they got to know that, you know, in the past when you were playing Edmonton and Dreisaitl and McDavid were on the bench, that it just felt like that you were going to be able to outscore them and take advantage of the Oilers. And now they're just getting depth up and down the lineup and showing that, at least in game one, that the first three rounds wasn't a fluke. So I guess I look at it probably more of a pessimistic way for Florida, that was a game where you played pretty well, could have easily had won, did not. And as we know, in a seven-game series, when you throw away games, it could come back to bite you, especially against a team that has a guy like Connor McDavid, who just looks right now that he is dialed in. Like, there's this guy just looks like somebody that's like, I am not going to let another opportunity in this round slip away. And that's the way that I took out of game one. He was just so fired up, even the way he is with the media after game. Mm. Like, he's almost showing no joy. Like, there is a, like, he is in for the kill right now, and that's got to be a scary proposition for Florida.
Yeah, and a delightful proposition for hockey viewers across the continent. Mike, I thought we were going to, you know, use up all your time talking Stanley Cup Final, and I loved that game so much that we could have easily done so. But I never look a gift horse in the mouth, and the Canucks hired Brett McLean, who's been in the Wild organization for the last 7 years. I know for a fact that you're very familiar with his work, his reputation, what he brings to the table. What can you tell our audience about what the Canucks are getting in new assistant coach Brett McLean?
Yeah, well, first of all, great guy. I haven't looked at the chart, but I assume he played with Foote in Colorado. He's obviously from the area. He owns a B&A brewing, I believe, in Kelowna, which is that bowling alley / brewery. I believe he does. At least he used to. So he is obviously great familiarity with BC and all that stuff. In Minnesota, he did a great job as an assistant coach. Did a little bit of everything: PP, PK, PK at the end. A couple years ago, when the Wild fired Tim Army in Iowa, Bill Guerin basically went to Brett McLean, and I don't want to say forced, but I will say forced him to become the Iowa head coach. He really didn't want to. One, he has young kids that are big into hockey in Minnesota. He didn't want to be away from them because he wasn't going to move them down there. But Brett was probably convinced by Bill Guerin that he would have more job security being the new Iowa coach than probably being one of the assistants. Because it was getting to the point where I think he wanted to really change things up behind the bench in Minnesota and not fire Dean Evason, which meant tackle the assistants. So he basically forced him to go down there. He goes down there, and they have two of the worst years that you can imagine in the AHL. So I think he was really eager to get back to being an assistant coach in the NHL. He's a tremendous guy. Chico Rush's son-in-law, by the way. I think he'll do a great job in that role. I think he's more assistant coach than head coach. And now I'll be interested more to see what the Wild do. Do they have a coaching search in Iowa, or do they hire Ben Simon, who's on Brett McLean's staff in Iowa, who was a long time coach in Grand Rapids? We'll see. But I think he'll do a really good job, alongside Adam there in Vancouver.
Another potential Minnesota-Vancouver connection, or at least one that a lot of us here are speculating on, is the future of Marco Rossi. And I know you've written about this at The Athletic, Michael. You've talked to Bill Guerin. Just give us a sense of where things stand from Minnesota's perspective on the potential of trading Marco Rossi. And if they were to go down that road, what kind of demands, what kind of trade package would have to be coming back the other way to satisfy the Wild?
Well, I definitely hear through, you know, really good sources that Vancouver really likes Marco and is very interested in Marco. Now, does that mean it via trade? Does it mean an offer sheet, one or the other? Who knows? I do think that he's a tremendous player. I think that Wild fans are really confused how it's gotten to this point, that the Wild, who in 25 years have essentially drafted and developed three top six centers in history in Koivu, Eriksson-Ek and Rossi, are now going to finally have this 23-year-old that has 60 points this year, 24 goals, had 20 goals last year, all rookie team, and now they might trade him. It just comes down to, I don't think that Bill Guerin really feels that he can function in the playoffs. He's undersized. He doesn't lack courage. He just is undersized. But if you look at all his metrics, Thomas, and I know you're into that, I mean, just go to NHL Edge and look at where he gets all his shots and his goals. He goes right.
Yeah, he's a dog.
I mean, he's as determined as he could be. He's mm-hmm. a total pro. If Vancouver gets him, they'd be extremely, extremely lucky to get him, because he's just going to continue to get better and better, just because he is such an absolute professional. And I don't agree with the Wild. I think he absolutely can function in the playoffs. I think they went in preemptively into the playoffs and just felt they weren't going to function, and immediately in game one just threw him on the fourth line, even though he wasn't the one that really deserved to go down there. And he never could get away from there. And now they've really ruined that ability. He turned out a 5-year, $25 million deal back in February-ish, January. And I think that they countered with a shorter term deal. Now I don't think they are willing to sign that bridge deal because they'd be worried that he'd be buried on the third and fourth lines over the term of the contract. So he really wants, like, you know, Matt Boldy type money. I think the good news for Marco is that wherever he gets traded, whoever is trading for him knows they're going to have to pay him in some capacity, whether it's signing that bridge deal, signing him long term, but he's there because he's wanted. And I think that at the end of the day, as disappointed as Marco is, as confused about this as he is, this is all going to be good for him if he winds up getting traded. I don't know if it's going to be good for the Wild. A lot of pressure on Bill Guerin to get a really good package back. He's, you know, 23-year-old centers just don't grow on trees that produce like Marco, and you know, he's going to want, you know, a significant package in return. Obviously, there's the relationship with both Jim Rutherford and Patrick Alvin there in Vancouver, so that makes a lot of sense. And so we'll see where it goes, but I definitely get the impression that we're going to see him getting a new change of address here by the end of the month.
Finally, just before we let you go, Michael, I got to ask the obligatory Brock Besser question, you know, constant connection with Minnesota. Now he's just less than a month away from being a pending UFA. Do you get the sense that the Wild will be bidders for his services?
You know, I think they're going to be bidders. I just don't know how much and what the length and what the money is going to be. You know, I don't get the impression also that Brock even is totally gung-ho on, like, I want to play at home. You know, I know there's always that connection. Obviously, the Wild have a lot of respect for him. We all know I do. I've written a ton on him over the years, ever since I sat down with him at a Burnsville Caribou when he was 17 years old on his draft year. You know, he's a great kid. I think it'll be good for him to get a change of scenery, you know, and we'll see where it goes. But I don't want to predict. Like, I was ready to predict that if Brock Nelson went to market, that he was going to be a Minnesota Wild. Mm-hmm. I'm not entirely convinced that Brock Besser will. I'm sure they're going to be interested. It's just, again, it's going to come down to what the term is, what the length, what the salary is, and then Brock's also going to have to make a real good decision on whether or not he wants to play at home with all those distractions, yeah, with all his buddies around, or if he wants to, you know, kind of get away from those distractions and go somewhere else.
Mike, great stuff. Really appreciate it. Thank you for doing this, and hopefully we can chat again soon sometime.
Yeah. See you guys. Take care.
That is Michael Russo from The Athletic. Lots to get into there, but as mentioned, we will now go live to hear from Adam Foote discuss the additions to his coaching staff for the Canucks.
To speak clearly, we're going to start off this Zoom availability by hearing from Adam a bit about his process in selecting the assistant coaches, and then we will turn it over to the media for questions. If you do have a question, please indicate so using the raise hand function. For now, I'll turn it over to Adam to talk about the process. Thank you.
Hey, everyone. Sorry, I'm in a loud area here. Thanks for joining. I'm not sure who all joined, but I know you guys have had patience while we go through this process, and you know, it took some time, but it was very exciting, and I learned a lot and got to meet some really good hockey people and open up some new relationships. But we're sitting in a position now where we're very excited about our coaching staff moving forward.
Thank you, Adam. We will turn it over now to Gemma Karsten-Smith, Canadian Press.
Hi, Adam. Hope you're doing well. Can you tell us where this loud area is?
I'm at a Blue Jay game. How's that one?
Oh,
first
nice.
Time in about 20 years.
That sounds amazing. Good.
Yeah.
Well, I just wanted to ask what you feel like this trio adds to your staff. Maybe we can start with Kevin Dean and work from there.
Well, you know what? The D coach is a great question. The defense coach is really what I wanted to deal with first. You know, I'm going to just tell you guys how it went down so there's no speculation. But obviously, Luke Richardson, who I played with in Columbus and a friend of mine, was a guy that was still going for a head coaching position. And Dean was under him in Chicago, but also Dean had, you know, history in Boston. You know, and as a penalty killer and a defense coach, I always liked how Chicago killed penalties, and you know, I was wondering what that connection was. And, you know, when I got this position, I looked into it deeper and got a great relationship with Joe Sacco, and obviously Forbes played in Boston. And, you know, I know Seth Jones from the Colorado area, and everything, you know, that I learned about Dean is I liked it more and more and more. And we actually opened up the relationship real early, and we spoke almost every day throughout the World Championship. And, you know, he did a great job with Garley on that PK. Garley was hopping over the boards as the first PK unit guy over there. I think he gained a lot of confidence. And this was his first year, Garley, with us. You know, Rick trusted him. And I asked Rick if he could kill, and Rick put some trust in Garley and myself too. And I thought Garley did a great job killing Collins this year, and he's just going to grow from being with Dean and the World Championship and having success and winning that championship. So I loved that the Dean, I felt like he, you know, with our defensive anchor along with our goaltending, and, you know, when things aren't right or we're in, you know, a hostile environment, or I always believe the D at the anchor and stay stable until we get control of a hockey game. And I believe his personality and the way he carries himself with that calm demeanor is what I was looking for. I felt like he's going to be himself, but I liked how he was like myself as far as the calm demeanor and being strong back there when things get shaky. And he's got a ton of experience. And the way we spoke about the game, felt like I've known him a very long time. And, you know, I knew within the second or third phone call that this was the guy for us. And we just had to, you know, communicate and open up this relationship where he would feel comfortable. And I'm very excited about him being, you know, down that side of the bench and let him do his thing. And I think he'll do a great job with our defense.
And can you touch on what Scott Young and Brett McLean bring to this group?
Well, Scotty, I mean, if you look at his history, this guy's played 1,200 games, and Scott and I came into Quebec at the same time, and he was working for this organization the last 3 or 4 years, and before that with them in Pittsburgh. Scott worked with at BU with David Quinn, and David Quinn was the last 2-3 guys where we were really trying to grab before we got in the plane, and I'll get to that in a minute, but I'm only saying this because Quinny, who I know, started out, you know, Erie when I was playing in Colorado, and I ended up building a good relationship with David Quinn, and if he was going to get another head coaching job, the first guy he was going after was Scott Young. And Scott's kind of like in a situation where I was with Rick, where we did a lot of other things because we weren't ready to, you know, put that time in to be a coach in the time that's needed, because we both wanted to be with our family. And he's in a situation now where he can put that time in, and someone that I would call the glue guy, maybe how I started out with Rick, and someone that I trust and respect. And I mean, this guy's pedigree, you know, he's coached 2 years with Quinn at BU, and then he's coached both Olympic teams. But, you know, you look at what he's won, 3 world championships he was in, he's won a World Cup, he's in 3 of those, he's got Olympic silver, 2 Stanley Cups as a player, you know, I'm not sure if it's 1 or 2, you know, in management, but I'm real excited to have him, his knowledge, and, you know, he's there to support all of us in that coaching group where, you know, my first year with Rick, I wasn't doing PK, but I was supporting Yosi and, you know, I guess you would call it, I call it the glue guy, going around and making sure everyone's just okay and sending the message out. And I think he's a big part of this, a big piece. And then with McLean, you know, at first we're really going for, it's hard to find a head coach that out there that had that experience and can help and support the group as an assistant role. And, you know, I had Sacco in Colorado when he was a rookie coach, always connected with him and had a great relationship. And we didn't know what was going to happen in Boston there. And he ended up, you know, but he was someone we're looking at, and David Quinn as well, which, you know, we're looking at. And I think he went back to New York, and all along we were going after this, trying to look at a head coach, but Brett McLean was always in the mix. I've known Brett a very long time, and if you look at his history, when he started with Minnesota, he was with Tim Army in Iowa, and then he jumped up with Evanston for 3 years and was asked. I was waiting to get a hold from Evanston, and I didn't get a hold of him for 3 or 4 days, and I needed to hear what I felt I knew, and he really liked Brett, and he was the one that asked Brett along with Billy Garen to go down to the minors and be a head coach. They felt like he had head coach material. But you look at his power play, he came in the first year when Kaprizov came in, and then his third year, the last 15 games. I could be wrong on the games exactly where he may have gotten hurt. I think he got hurt, but you look at those stats and analytics, he had that group up to 25 for part of the season percent. And to hear Evanston say to me at the World Championship he wanted McLean, if Brunette couldn't come for some personal reasons, Brunette ended up going, and Evanston was asked if he could handle, the personalities of McKinnon and a Crosby, and Evanston was to the staff, yes, it won't bother him at all. Handle it with grace, and his presentations and his game plan are big, and it's something I always felt about Brett I loved. And to hear Evanston speak that highly of him, and then also Anaheim was after him real hard. Joel Quinville, who coached me, someone that, we know his pedigree and what a great coach he is, him going after Brett as well could show everyone, validate how I put him on such a high pedestal. But he's a great addition, a little bit younger than maybe a couple guys we were looking at, which I love. He's got the energy, great practice plan. He can dig and show guys the things maybe a Yogi or the Sedins would show on a regular basis. So we're real excited to have him.
And we'll turn it over to David Quadrelli, Canucks Army.
Hey, Adam, I'm just wondering if you can provide just a quick breakdown on the duties of each coach, namely the power play.
Yeah, well, Brett will have the power play, but, Scott Young is a power play guy. He did it for the Olympic team, and his eyes will be on it as well. All our eyes will be on it. But and then the PK, obviously, Dean will have that, and I did the PK last year, so we'll share a lot of information. And Scott will be looking at the whole group, special projects with the Sedins and Kroger, who's our skills coach, and supporting the whole group. And almost like I said, that glue guy, the relationship guy. So it's, I believe it's a good group, and I'm excited in the roles they will have.
And if I may, just Derek Forbert re-signing this week, what's he brought to the group and what made him a good fit for next season as well?
Well, just stability. I mean, it gives the youth time. I mean, we have exciting youth. I mean, I don't know what Wielander will do. And, as defense, everyone sees the athleticism in those three young D and sees their sparks. And it's really a fine, seeing what they do at the AHL level and compared to the NHL when the temperature goes up, it's two different monsters for sure. And you don't want to throw a young guy in a situation that he may not be ready for. I mean, when we see him make a big splash and make some of these youngers make a hell of a play, we all think that maybe he's ready. And I think if you can put him in it, I wouldn't say the right term is not baby steps, but you got to be very careful, in my opinion, with young D and when they're ready to take a full-time job. And Ford just gives us depth. He's a great penalty killer. He's tough. He's a great person, good leader, brings a lot of energy, and he gives us situations where, we don't know if Forbes is going to 82 games, we're not sure, but it gives us depth, and we don't want to rush young guys, and we'll see how they are and how much they're ready for as time goes by through training camp.
We'll turn to Adam Kurzenblatt, Canucks are Vancouver, oh my goodness. The Hockey News. Apologies.
As part of the announcement, it was also announced that Sergei Gonchar and Dylan Crawford won't be returning. Do you have a plan to have a similar situation like last year where you have a part-time assistant coach like Gonchar that might come in for a couple weeks to work with specific groups?
No, it'll be Dean and I will be the, you know, I'm the head coach, but Dean and I have that part covered. And as far as Dylan, we're looking right now for another video coach.
And moving on to the future, what is your plan to utilize the Sabines? Because we've seen them in development roles. Is your goal to kind of give them more responsibility for the next season?
Well, you know what? A lot of that's up to them. And, you know, their development role, but they've been key to, you know, they're guys that are there for you, whatever you want them to do. And, you know, as their kids get older and move on, they're going to have decisions to make, whether they'll be sticking around Sweden or moving, or sorry, Vancouver, or moving on. And their role, we'll discuss with them. I see them, and we had talking about more before practice, like maybe taking three or four guys out about a 3-on-3, some plays offensively, 4-on-4, you know, obviously individual skill with some young guys, but or special projects we'll have them doing. So they're the type of guys that are there to work and you know, go to battle with you, and they're open to anything. I would just like to maybe do maybe more of a schedule with them, and we'll you know, we're going to utilize them and take everything we get from them. They're great hockey minds, and they'll help us a lot.
All right, and we'll take our final questions here from Randeep Janda, Sportsnet 650.
Oh, can you hear me now?
We got you, Randeep.
All right. Yeah, Adam, just wanted to ask you about Yogi Svechkovsky. Obviously, going to Philadelphia, you shared a bench with him. You know, what kind of impact did he have on this team? Obviously, had a big role in practice.
I mean, Yogi's my friend. I love Yogi. And, you know, he had a position here. And I think during the process, like when I'm looking for an assistant forward coach, I can't care. Like, I thought he would be our power play guy, but I've got to go through the process, and I didn't know who he would end up with. You know, so I think he was waiting to hear about that. You know, Rick Tocchet had developed myself. He developed Yogi, and Yogi made a decision. I think I had a good feeling that this was going to happen when I had a chance to play with Alex Tangay for a long time and win a cup with him, and he reached out to me, and he had to turn down Philadelphia as a power play coach. And it was something that he was one of those guys we wanted to talk to. But when that happened, I wasn't surprised when Yogi called me a couple of days later. And, you know, there's zero hard feelings. He's a friend of mine. And like I said, a guy like Rick developed him. And if that's where he's going to feel more comfortable and be able to do his niche or continue to be that power play coach, which could have been here, that is just fine. You know, it happens, and no hard feelings at all. And moving forward with a guy like Brett McClain, I mean, I feel like there's similar guys, and Brett has a little bit more experience, but Philadelphia's getting a great coach, and so is Vancouver Canucks.
Alrighty, and that will conclude today's media availability. Thank you all so much.
All right, there is Adam Foote speaking to some media members via Zoom on the new additions to his coaching staff. And I mean, I'm glad we had some 650 representation, but Randeep, come on, unmute yourself before you ask the question, buddy. Tough, tough times for Randeep Janda on the Zoom
right
there.
Who's the commercial where it's like, can you hear me now?
Oh, who was that back in the day?
Anyone know?
Some American one.
Yeah.
It's got to be like a cell service commercial.
Verizon. There you go.
Randeep Verizon Wireless.
There you go. By the way.
Can you hear me now?
I love that Adam Foote was doing that Zoom live from the Blue Jays game in Toronto right now, where they're piling on. They've broken the game open. 6-0 lead over the Phillies. And I love that I could hear, we have the game on in the studio, and I could hear the crowd swelling behind Adam Foote at certain key moments of the game as we watched them unfold on the TV. So that was a great feature of that Zoom. Okay, we'll take a break. We went long here listening to Adam Foote, but lots to unpack in the next segment.
Oh, Adam Foote's such good luck for the Blue Jays. Oh, my God.
Adam he's Foote. Going nuts. He got off the Zoom and he's going nuts as they tack on another couple of runs.
I think Adam Foote should be in consideration for Blue Jays manager.
Blue Jays glue
given,
guy.
Given his impact here, Blue Jays glue guy.
Yeah.
The Glue Jays.
Yeah. That is a bit of a tongue twister. Blue Jays glue guy.
Blue Jays glue guy. I think they're just the Glue Jays.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay, we'll take a break, but lots to get into, including I don't want to just pass over what Mike Russo had to say.
I thought you were going
to
say put the cart before the horse after we were talking glue, and I was like, bro.
No. Oh,
my
I wanna,
God.
I don't want to offend all our horse listeners out there, notably Jason Bruff. He does not listen to the show, unfortunately. But
is he a big horse guy?
People often say that he looks like a horse.
Ah.
Yeah.
I think it's just because he's negative, so he's always
neighing. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, you knew exactly where I was going. That sucks.
I saw where you were going there.
Man.
All right, we got to get out. But what I was saying is I don't want to skip over what Mike Russo had to say about the Canucks' interest in Marco Rossi. So we can dig into that. More on the Canucks, more on the Stanley Cup next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Mike Halford
and Jason Bruff.
Join us for Halford and Bruff in the Morning weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m. on Sportsnet 650.
Or on demand anytime through your favorite podcast app.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drance. We are broadcasting live from the Kintech studio. Kintech Footwear and Orthotics working together with you in step. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And I didn't mention it earlier when we had Mike Russo on, but guests on Sportsnet 650 call in on the hotline powered by Power West Industries. Don't get caught in the dark when it matters most. Visit them at powerwest.ca today. They keep the lights on. We're just going to get that clip from Mike Russo ready momentarily here, but before we do that, do you have any further thoughts on what we heard from Adam Foote live from the Toronto Blue Jays game, live from the Rogers Center in Toronto, speaking to the media on Zoom?
So we were talking a little bit about experience and just the idea of having been through it, you know what I mean? And you know, this is part of it in terms of like you are a PR guy, you call your head coach, right? And you're like, hey, are you free to do a brief Zoom call? It'll only be about 15 minutes on Thursday afternoon. First-time head coach, wants to be accommodating, wants to be a team player, mm-hmm. right? Hey, yeah, no problem. Anything you need, you know, I'll be at a Blue Jays game, but I'm happy to take 15 minutes to do that. No problem. It's just a call, right? Yeah, just a call. Okay. Experienced head coach, hey, sorry, I already have plans that day. Let's do it Friday morning. Because there's no difference. Like, if we hear from Foote tomorrow, that's fine. You know, I think it's helpful that Foote has put a bunch of stuff out there in terms of like the exact composition of this staff. I think
he was very candid,
very open, but
which is great.
But it just doesn't
love
make
that.
It just doesn't make sense to do an availability when you're at a Blue Jays game. The actual right answer is not today, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And but again, that's something that a head coach that has done this for years, for whom like these rhythms of availabilities and media briefings and updates are second nature. Right. And again, that has no bearing on how he'll fare, how successful he'll be, the sort of leader of men that he's going to be, his tactical decisions. Right. Like, it's not a commentary on that. It's just this is the sort of stuff, you know. Right. Or you haven't been through and you'll learn real quick. But you can see the seams in moments, especially if you have a good sense of how NHL teams operate. That's like a perfect example where it's just like didn't really make sense to do an availability at a Blue Jays game.
Yeah, probably not. But anyways, now we have the blow-by-blow and the breakdown of what all the different members of his staff are going to do. Scott Young, the glue guy, comparing it to his role, what Foote's role was at first under Rick Tocchet. Also confirming that Brett McLean will run the power play. Before we talk about anything else lingering from the presser from Adam Foote, just before we heard from Adam Foote, we were chatting with Michael Russo, who, of course, covers the Minnesota Wild, but also the NHL generally for The Athletic. And you know, not to disparage any other beat writers around the NHL, because there's some very good ones, but Mike Russo is one of the most respected, well-regarded, plugged-in, connected beat writers in the NHL. So when he's reporting something, when he's saying he's hearing from a good source, that holds a lot of weight. And he dropped a very interesting Canucks-related tidbit during the course of our conversation about Marco Rossi. So let's hear now from Mike Russo.
Well, I definitely hear through, you know, really good sources that Vancouver really likes Marco and is very interested in Marco. Now, does that mean it via trade? Does it mean an offer sheet? One or the other? Who knows? I do think that he's a tremendous player. I think that Wild fans are really confused how it's gotten to this point, that the Wild, who in 25 years have essentially drafted and developed three top six centers in history in Koivu, Eriksson Ek and Rossi, are now going to finally have this 23-year-old that has 60 points this year, 24 goals, had 20 goals last year, all rookie team, and now they might trade him. You know, it just comes down to, I don't think that Bill Guerin really feels that he can function in the playoffs. He's undersized. He doesn't lack courage. He just is undersized. But if you look at all his metrics, Thomas, and I know you're into that, I mean, just go to NHL Edge and look at where he gets all his shots and his goals. He goes right.
Yeah, he's a dog.
I mean, he is. He's just, and he's as determined as he could be. He's mm-hmm. a total pro. You know, like if Vancouver gets him, they'd be extremely, extremely lucky to get him, because he's just going to continue to get better and better just because he is such an absolute professional.
I love that in the clip that the rest of the shows will be running, and it now includes Russo being like, you love your analytics, Trance.
I, you know what? I like that he used the tone. I like that he used the tone of someone who showed up to a party with like something illicit to share with a friend. You know what I mean? Like, oh, I got really good cigars, like some Cubans. I know you're into that, you know, or something. I mean,
I know you're a dirtbag who loves this stuff.
but he used that exact tone. You know what I mean? Like, I brought some Everclear. I know you're into that. It's like, you're right. I'm a garbage human being.
Let's get into the gutter. Let's do it. I know you're into that, Dress. Yeah. Anyways, but obviously,
like Stefan Diggs on a boat.
What stands out there is, again, right off the top, saying he's heard from a very good source that Vancouver, quote, really likes Marco. That's Marco Rossi, and is very interested in him. And we've seen, obviously, now, since Marco Rossi's name has been out there and the usage in the playoffs, his commentary, and hey, Vancouver's looking for a top six center, a young top six center. Wow, okay, that makes a lot of sense. But I don't know that we've seen him as like, oh, teams that might be interested, and a long list that includes the Vancouver Canucks. I don't know that we've heard as direct a report from it, certainly not from this established a source and well regarded a source as Michael Russo, that it's not just us connecting the dots, that there is real interest and a real appreciation for the player from the Canucks' perspective. And that's interesting, because I think a lot of our discussions about Marco Rossi have been, well, you know, is he really the Canucks type? Like, a little undersized, you know, not doesn't bring that speed element, not right-handed. You know, the value's probably there, but do you really see it from a fit perspective? And what we're hearing now from Michael Russo is, you know, maybe that's not such a concern. They do like the player, and they are willing to look past some of the perceived flaws and the physical limitations that Bill Guerin is focusing on in Minnesota right now.
Yeah, so, I mean, look, there's a world where if you got a Pettersson bounce back and you acquired Marco Rossi for just about anything, okay? Like name me your high-end, name me your Marco Rossi prospect package that would actually make you uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
That you would, no, seriously, name it.
Oh, right now?
Yeah.
Start
with 15th overall.
Yeah, so it's going to be 15th overall.
Okay.
So are we doing, like, we're doing pick, player, prospect?
Yeah, and I want you to go high end, not like what you think they might accept. Like, you're an NHL,
okay, so it's
be a GM mode.
It's 15th overall.
Something you actually would be like, if you were reacting to it live on air, you'd be like, ooh.
Probably 15th overall. And then I would say, to get me uncomfortable, we're probably talking Lekker Mäki as the prospect.
Okay.
And then roster players, no one that makes me that uncomfortable, to be honest, but I guess like Hoglander,
Lekker Mäki. Yeah, yeah, I think you nailed it, because it's like, ooh, that's a lot of upside to give up.
Yeah.
Still a win.
That's young guys.
Still a massive win. Still a massive take it to the bank, say yes before they hang up win. I mean, we're talking about a 60-year-old.
This guy's a medical marvel.
A miracle. 23-year-old 60-goal center. Who?
60-point center.
What'd I say?
60 goals.
Oh, my
like,
God.
Man, now we're really talking.
He's 60 years old. He scored 60 goals this year.
He scored his age at 60. This is incredible.
I'm still reeling from the Blue Jays presser. Anyway, this is the profile of player that never shakes loose. Mm-hmm. And for this type of player to potentially become available on the market in the wake of a season that went the way it did for the Canucks and a trade that they felt they had to make to reset their core group, involving an 80-point center last year, but a guy who's had 100 points or flirted with it in two of the last four, right? You make that trade, which the team knows is an L the day they make it, right? It's a trade made under duress from the organization's mm-hmm. point of view. You make that trade, you enter a new cycle, a new phase of your team building cycle, and you land Marco Rossi 4 months later and end up ahead net than you were before that deal. Like, oh yeah, now we have another first pair caliber defender on our team, and we have a younger center who's, look, not JT Miller today, but given that JT Miller's 30 years old and he's 23, like they're going to meet in the middle within 18 months, probabilistically speaking. You know what I mean? Like, JT Miller's going to lose a step or two. Marco Rossi's probably, like, he's just entering his statistical prime. They're going to meet in the middle really quickly. You are ahead of where you were, even dropping Lekkerimäki in the first and Hoglander, than you would have been if not for all the drama that caused you to nuke this team in the first place. What a gift. That's like manna from heaven. That's Deus Ex Machina stuff. That's a unique opportunity that you absolutely cannot afford to miss if that opportunity actually presents itself this summer from a Canucks perspective, period. Like, yep. I don't know what else to say. You will never get a chance to place a bet like that. And I don't care that he's not an elite skater, and I don't care that he's 5'9". I mean, I do. Don't get me wrong. He's not the perfect fit. But who cares about fit when you have a chance to place a bet this promising? You know, like, this is what it's about.
Well, and that's one of the things I find fascinating is this Canucks management traditionally does really prioritize the fit and the characteristics. You know what I mean? That's what they really look for. They want, okay, maybe we're going to overpay or the value isn't there, but this is the type of player that we prioritize and that we value having on the team. And so, not to say that, like, just because he's short doesn't mean there's not things to really like in his game, obviously, that we see, that other people see, and that apparently in this instance, the Canucks management sees as well. And it was also interesting to hear from Russo from Minnesota's perspective. I mean, one, just laying it out bluntly, like, Bill Guerin doesn't think that Marco Rossi can win in the playoffs. Like, it's just black and white kind of from his perspective. And then also, like, to hear that despite all of the kind of, well, I'm not in any hurry to trade him, that the contract status thing suggests, like, as Russo said, like, yeah, I would bet on him being in a different place next year.
There is no type of profile you want to seize on more than player who team thinks can't win in the playoffs. Remember Nick Bonino?
Yes.
Like, that's the one that always comes to mind for me. Like, he just can't get it done in the playoffs, and then he wins two consecutive Stanley Cups. And how many big goals did he score for the Penguins? Like, he was the classic. Smart enough to not hurt you defensively, skilled enough to punish opposition mistakes. Just a good pro, hung around forever. I mean, how long was his career after he left Vancouver? Like, he was
significant.
He, like, just left the league. Like, was this the first full season that he didn't play in? Yeah. This was the first full season he didn't play in. And he was still having,
that's wild,
like 20, 30 point seasons until the pandemic hit. You know, like, he was still a 30 point per 82 game guy. The year after the pandemic, in that pandemic abbreviated season. I mean, that is the guy. That is like the low end example. Now, what if the guy had way, way more upside than that?
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's a unique profile. We just don't see top two line centerman Rossi's size. We just don't see it. And if we do, Braden Point would be an example. They are the fastest kid alive.
Yeah.
Right? They are, wow, that guy's a guy who actually meshes and can keep up with McDavid off the rush.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, they're that guy. And Rossi's not that guy. Rossi's a little more deliberate, a little bit slower. He actually made, I hate to put it this way, but big strides this season in terms of his pace, I thought, watching them play. But he's still like an above average mover, not an elite mover. And that's a tough combination when you're also 5'9". But, man, I love watching guys that are willing to go to the dirty areas and that are creative and tough enough to dig pucks out in those areas and punish opponents. And like, that's my favorite type of player. People said Connor Garland was never going to be able to get it done in the Western Conference in the playoffs. He was one of Vancouver's standout performers, if not their all-out best forward who wasn't JT Miller and Brock Besser, right? Brock Besser, but short list of the best Canucks forwards on that run in 2024, right? Miller 1, Besser 2, Garland 3, not controversial, right? Clearly the three best players for the Canucks up front. Some guys just have it. Do you need to be careful about what else you do if Rossi's the guy you land? Yeah, probably. Do you need to be mindful of team speed? Sure. But, like, this is a team that employs Dakota Joshua. This is a team that employs Drew O'Connor. Right? Like, there are fits. Guys who are, you know, not necessarily top six skilled on their own, but can complement guys like Garland, guys like Rossi. Like, those guys exist on this roster. And I think that's a good opportunity to lean into it. If you play Garland with Drew O'Connor and find them a center, right? Because I don't know if you want Rossi there. Although Rossi's ability to finish in tight, honestly, that's not the worst. Or and you play Rossi on a separate line with, you know, Drew O'Connor and X guy. I'm interested.
Of my perspective on the fit versus value thing is, like, it's great to prioritize fit as you get closer and closer to being a true contender, right?
Totally.
That's when it becomes much more legitimate and more important to really prioritize, okay, who is going to be the finishing piece for us? The farther away you get, you need to make those upside bets. You need to be more focused on value. And I'm very refreshed and, like, pleasantly surprised to hear that the Canucks are potentially taking that approach and that they do like Marco Rossi. And Jeff from North Van texts in, you're not really selling this guy short, but also not fast. Oh, that's why he's available. Right, really, to put it bluntly, it's because of his physical tools or lack thereof, the kind of ideal physical tools that NHL teams prize. That's why he's available. I've said this a million times, right? The guys who are going to move have something perceived to be wrong with them. They are distressed in some way, whether that's character concerns, whether that's production, whether that's physical limitations, whatever it is. So you kind of got to pick your poison. And at least with Marco Rossi, yeah, are there legitimate questions to ask about, okay, what does this mean for the rest of our roster build? How do we have to, is it awkward to build around one of your top two centers having this type of physical profile? There absolutely are, but at least you're getting someone with really good character bona fides, right? Hard worker, all of those things. People rave about that from him, and who's also produced. So you're getting a guy, at least you know you can plug into the lineup and he's going to be productive. He's going to work hard for you. And that's a lot more than you can say for some of the other potential names that we've floated out there that are much, much more speculative. So the fact that he's on the market, that he could be available for a reasonable price, I think you have to overlook those concerns and you have to be willing to bet on a player like that. All right. We'll take a break here. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. We can continue that conversation. Lots of questions and thoughts coming in on that. We can get back into the Stanley Cup final as well. And maybe talk a little bit more about the changes to the Canucks coaching staff. Lots to get into here on Canucks Talk. Sportsnet 650.
I'm at a Blue Jay game. How's that one?
Oh,
first
nice.
Time in about 20 years.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drance. We are live from the Kintec studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and reno warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at dunbarlumber.com. Hope Adam Foote's still having a great time at the Blue Jays game in Toronto after he took some time out of his schedule to do the Zoom earlier today.
He chose a great one for his first
game in 20 years.
You know, it'd be such a sick capstone on today is if we get the visual of, like, Adam Foote without spilling his beer catching a foul ball. And it's like wired. Like, if he hadn't been there and caught it so expertly without spilling a single drop of beer, it, like, would have hit a child.
That would be awesome.
But, like, Adam Foote is the hero of the day. Does everyone think about this when they go to Blue Jays or any baseball game whatsoever?
Are you ready?
Like, this is my moment. Maybe.
This is going to finally catapult me to stardom.
No, I don't think of it like that. I just want the moment of being like, yeah.
Yeah,
it was no big deal.
I saved that kid.
And then you know what you do if you want to be really classy?
You give the kid the ball, yeah.
No. First you take out a Sharpie and sign it.
Oh my gosh. Why are you carrying a Sharpie around with you?
In case you catch a foul ball at the game. What do you mean?
I think the kid would be so confused. Like, are you a baseball player?
Absolutely not. You put a date on it, and you're like, here, enjoy. Enjoy your commemorative ball.
You have put a lot of thought into this. What? I am curious about...
You haven't?
Not that far. I am curious about where exactly foot... Like, was he just in the seats? Because you could hear the crowd. Was he just, like, FaceTiming? And the person
maybe
front
he
of
was in a suite and he went to the bathroom?
Maybe, yeah.
I feel like that's what I'd do. I'd be like in a suite and I'd go to the washroom.
I just imagine sitting in a Blue Jays game and be like, is this Vancouver Canucks head coach doing a press conference in front of me? What's going on here?
Oh, man, I hope I have a chance to catch a foul ball and save him from it without spilling a sip of my beer. And then I'll sign it and give it to him.
Perfect.
This person who's much more famous than me, what they really want
is a signed
is a ball.
Signed foul ball
I have
from
signed.
Me. Okay, lots of people texting in on the Marco Rossi conversation, and the most popular one, or one of the most popular ones, comes from Ben in East Van, who says, what's Rossi going to cost salary-wise? Report out there is, and I think Michael Russo mentioned this when he was on with us as well, is looking for kind of that 7x7 deal, similar to what Matt Boldy got from the Minnesota Wild. And of course, Boldy has really hit another level since he signed that deal, but that's why you sign young players to these long contracts, right? You're hoping that they'll hit additional levels or higher levels once you sign them. And the report was he turned down a 5x5 offer. Now, it sounds like maybe there would be some openness to a bridge, but if you're looking long term, 7x7 is kind of the ballpark or the starting point maybe for a Marco Rossi negotiation.
Yeah, I mean, that's fine.
Yeah.
Just because the Wild hit an absolute home run by gambling at the exact right moment on Matt Boldy doesn't mean that 7x7 for Marco Rossi is going to age poorly.
No, exactly.
You know, and
that's what I mean. It's like you can't be like, well, Matt Boldy is way better than him. Yeah, but they like look at when they signed that. How many games in the NHL did Matt Boldy have when they signed him to that extension? I think it was like less than a full season, like maybe split over multiple seasons. But I don't know that he'd played 80 games when he signed to that deal. That was very much a bet. And it's been an absolute home run. But that's kind of my point is like if you want to have the chance to capture that surplus value, you've got to be willing to take a swing and go long on a relatively young player.
Yeah, no question. And look, I mean, I know that Marco Rossi has played with some elite players.
Yeah, that's another one that's coming up. Can you address, you know, the idea that his production has been inflated playing with Boldy and especially obviously Kirill Kaprizov?
Yeah, and I mean, what are you going to do? Like, it's not your fault that you're a top six guy and your team has two elite wingers. You know what I mean? Like, what you want him to... What do you want them to do? Like, play those guys, play...
Mm-hmm.
We want to play Kaprizov with a less talented center. You know what I mean?
So they did in the playoffs.
That they did. But yeah, I mean, the thing about sort of his overall track record with Kaprizov and Boldy, especially this last season, as he sort of came into his own, you know, is generally speaking, like, yeah, both guys did better with him. Well, less so with Boldy, but in Kaprizov's case anyway, you know, they were productive with him. And I'm not going to give him credit for that more than I'm going to give them credit for that. But there's something to be said for helping them produce at a higher clip with him than they were without him, which, you know, is the case with both guys. So look,
it's at least a data point in favor of him being able to produce away from them, right? Like the fact that he's not just a passenger, he's adding something. He's additive in some way to those partnerships.
Yeah, or you know, I mean, maybe he is to quote the NHLPA lawyer in the arbitration case against Brendan Morrison, right? Maybe he is an elephant riding on the backs of, or sorry, a mouse riding on the backs of two elephants. Maybe, but that's fine. You can work around that. Now, the Canucks don't have elite wingers is sort of one of the issues here. I don't know that I view him as like a standalone top of the lineup driver, but I do view him as a guy who's been productive at absolutely every level at his at his age, like against his peers, right? Like we're talking about a guy who was elite, elite, elite in the OHL, 120 points in 56 games in his draft year. That is nothing to sniff at, my dude, right? We're talking about a guy who went through a multi-year bout with a severe complications from a COVID infection, pre-vax, and ended up sort of breaking out as a 21-year-old. No, 2001, yeah, as a 20-year-old in the AHL, 53 points in 63 games as a 20-year-old in the American League.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're excited in this market about, less production from Lekkerimäki.
Mm-hmm.
More goals, but less overall production. And I think, is Lekkerimäki 21? I think Lekkerimäki's a year older. Or at the moment.
Than
Rossi was in that season.
He's 20. No, so he hasn't turned 21 yet. He turns 21 in the summer.
July. So yeah. Point being. At every level, Rossi's just like hitting all of the benchmarks that you're looking for in a future top six center. And he's 23. So when you sign him for 7 years, you're not even worried about the backside of the deal.
Yeah, that's the other thing, right? It's at least not risky from that perspective, the aging one. Risky if he doesn't take those jumps or if he doesn't, you know, turn into a top-of-the-lineup driver away from Kaprizov and Boldy. But again, got to take risks. There's no safe way to radically improve the team this offseason.
Here's the last thing. You can suggest that Rossi's not the right guy. Fairly. He's mm-hmm. a passenger on a line with Boldy and Kaprizov. He wasn't the driver of those results. He's undersized for a top six forward. He's a little bit slower than I'd like. Whatever. I don't think you're wrong. I think all of that's fair to say.
Mm-hmm.
Now tell me the alternative you're looking at.
That's what it always comes back to.
Tell me the better target that exists.
Find the unicorn.
Yeah.
I will gladly stump for the unicorn,
yeah.
But there is no unicorn.
So
when it arrives, that'll be great. That'll yeah. be awesome. We'll all be in the unicorn's corner. Until that,
the unicorner.
Yeah, that's right.
until
that, we're going to have to make some compromises, and it's just a question of picking which compromises you're willing to live with, which compromises you're comfortable with. And for some people, it's I don't want to bet on, as you said, look, it's Braden Point. Basically in the league, who's an incredible skater as like short top of the lineup centers
yep.
on contending teams. So it's very reasonable to look at Marco Rossi and say, I don't want to bet on that because of the lack of similar players having success in the role you would want him in here in Vancouver. That's not an unfair position, but it's just the idea that any negatives on his resume or any negatives in his profile rule him out immediately because you're not finding the guy with no negatives.
The only other like realistic, credible solution that I can even come up with, because Pavel Zacha is a totally different caliber of guy.
Yeah.
You know, I like Pavel Zacha. I'll stump for Pavel Zacha. I in a lot of ways, I prefer the fit of a Pavel Zacha, but, you know, the upside is not there in the same way that it is with Marco Rossi. So the only other guy who, you could realistically find a way to get this summer that I would like really stump for is Caleb Desnoyer. And that requires getting up to pick 4 or 5.
Which, good luck. From 15?
I think you could do it.
But you're giving up a lot.
You are giving up a lot. But, we haven't talked about Patrick Johnston's latest.
Yeah, should we get into that? A couple of people have texted in about it.
I'm just saying.
Finish your thought
first.
In
a world
yeah.
where you're swinging big on dismantling this roster, I don't think getting up to the top five becomes...
Sure.
You know, like, if you're in the we're actually willing to move Elias Pettersson business, getting into the top five is no longer an unrealistic option for your hockey club, right? And Desnoyer is just an absolute dog. The problem is you're waiting at least 2 years and then probably another 2 years before you're getting, you know, top line impact. But I mean, short and look, in terms of bets to be top line caliber contributors, I'd take Desnoyer over Rossi, right? That's how highly I think of Rossi, or sorry, of Desnoyer.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's never a step that this organization's ever wanted to... This organization wants to swing the bat. They don't want to roll the dice.
Interesting.
What?
I like that phrasing.
Do you actually?
Yeah. No, I like it.
Yeah.
They want to swing the bat, for sure.
They want to
expect them to.
They want to swing the bat at something they can see in the here and now. They don't want to roll the dice on something that is uncertain.
You brought up Patrick Johnson's latest piece for Post Media in the Province. Now, I screenshotted this and put it out on Twitter and a little earlier, and I incorrectly misattributed it, which I feel bad.
And it's going viral too.
I know it's bad, like
a really good tweet. This is why, man, you're having a tough reporting day. Oh boy.
Well, Ben, so Kuzma is the PJ's colleague at Post Media, and he put it out like you would put out one of your own pieces.
How would you like it if people were like, and that's when Jamie Dodd said that annoying thing and had an annoying laugh, and he's always negative.
Yeah. I mean, people kind of say that about me anyway, so that's fine.
No one says that about you.
Yeah, well, sometimes. Anyways, the annoying laugh thing. Anyways, it was PJ.
It's our signature.
Apologies to PJ and Ben Kuzma for getting them mixed up, but it was Patrick Johnston's article. And it's basically built around something that got a little notice earlier in the week, which was Elias Pettersson not being a part of some of the marketing materials that they're sending to season ticket holders. And PJ comments on that, but also notes that Thatcher Demko missing from a lot of this too. The one picture that was going around, he's not in. There's also a video, I believe, that PJ references that Kevin Lankinen is a part of, but not Thatcher Demko. And then the quotes that I highlighted, and I think is an absolutely fascinating quote. I'll read the kind of longer part before it here, just to give you the full context. PJ writes, "It does make you wonder if Demko is quietly being shopped around. One league source said that trading Demko made sense to them, since he's a solid trade chip, even if he is coming off multiple seasons in a row with injuries, and could help bring back the kind of number two center the Canucks openly covet. Another source said management is looking to," and this is in quotes, "get rid of the emotionally soft, diva, drama-type, cancerous players without doing a traditional rebuild."
Tell us how you really feel, PJ.
Now.
Or no, this is a source, industry source.
League source. Now, it doesn't say team source, right? And it doesn't specify where the source is, but the fact that the first source quoted is a league source, I would tend to think this is another league source. So you do take it with a grain of salt, right? Like somebody from outside the Canucks in the league, maybe taking a chance to get something off their chest here. But I'll read it again. Management is looking to, quote, "get rid of the emotionally soft, diva, drama-type, cancerous players without doing a traditional rebuild." And that is a sharp, sharp quote. It's one thing to say, like, they're looking to limit the drama next year or whatever, right? You know, they want more professionals, more committed guys who want to be there. There are kind of nice politic ways to talk around this thing, but just coming out and saying, yeah, no, they want to get rid of the emotionally soft, diva, dramatic, cancerous guys. That is a really fascinating quote from a league source as relayed by Patrick Johnson. And, you know, it's plural there, right? I think a lot of people's minds, given all the drama that surrounded him, will immediately go to Elias Pettersson. But the quote doesn't say, like, oh, they want to get rid of Pettersson to reduce the drama. The quote says there's maybe multiple players that they would like to move to try to improve things. And I'm not going to speculate on who exactly those guys are, but the reason it really jumped out to me is, like, I think there is just this pretty prominent, even from people who are, you know, fans who are very positive about the future of Elias Pettersson and think he's been treated unfairly or really want Brock Besser to stay, want the Canucks to circle back and re-sign Brock Besser and, you know, want Demko long-term and an extension as well. I do think there's just this underlying kind of current of a desire for a new cast of characters. That's the way I would phrase it. Because I don't think there's an overwhelming desire for a rebuild. Some people certainly want it, of course. But I think more than anything, there's just a feeling of it's gotten a little stale. It's gotten a little tiresome with this group of players. And we've already started to see some of the turnover. I mean, even going back to Bo Horvat leaving and then JT Miller, obviously, this most recent season. We'll see if Brock Besser follows. But you hear, like, you get that sense from fans, and certainly, I mean, I've felt it watching this team and covering this team over the last 4 years or so, and then you hear a quote like that, and it makes me think, like, does management feel the same way? Does management feel like, you know what, we just need to freshen things up. We need to make changes to change the mood, to change the vibes, to change everything, all of that, all of those intangible things. We talk about Project Keep Quinn Hughes Happy. Don't you think that would go a long way, right? If you're shipping out, quote, the emotionally soft, diva, drama type, cancerous players?
I don't know, man. I'm not going anywhere toward cancerous players. Like, that's just so
that's
hard.
That's the quote. That's not my line.
I know.
That's the quote.
I'm not opining on it because it's just like, man, that's a lot.
That is loaded.
That's loaded. That's more than I'm willing to say about a core that I've never believed in. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. That's it. But
having said that,
part of me thinks, yeah, if you could. So part of me thinks that I would have more appetite to engage with this team and watch this team and track them with sort of less of the baggage.
The baggage is a great way of putting it. Like a clean, I said another, you know, another a new cast of characters, like a clean slate.
Yeah.
A reboot.
Right.
You know what I mean? It's like, I'm tired of watching these actors in these roles. Let's get some fresh blood in here.
For sure. I unfortunately think this core group has been through a lot. You know, you had the early success under Travis Green and in the bubble, and then the team absolutely slashed the budget, lost every single UFA, including key organizational figures like Jacob Markstrom and Chris Tanev.
Yeah.
And by the way, I'd throw Troy Stetcher in there too, just a guy who wore the jersey with pride and could do the damn job and do it well. Like, I'd throw Troy Stetcher in there too. Not obviously the same caliber of contributor as those guys, but nonetheless, Tyler Toffoli. Damn it, Tyler Toffoli's great with young players. Look at the relationships that he has with those guys in Montreal. You know, you don't think a guy like that might have been a useful go-between as fissures erupted between Pettersson and Miller in the ensuing seasons?
Mm-hmm.
I bet you he would have. That's a winner, man. So they lost all four of those guys, slashed the budget, brought in guys like Holtby and Schmidt who hated it here. Right, like just hated how the organization did its business. They all got sick from COVID. Some of their careers ended as a result of that. And Brandon Sutter, Pettersson got hurt that year, the wrist injury. I think there was a feeling internally that maybe he could have come back sooner while these guys, while the team was sort of playing. And I think that
was
sort
battling
of,
through COVID specifically, right?
Meanwhile, Miller's out there publicly stumping for the NHL to further delay the resumption of the regular season with the health and safety of his teammates in mind. And I think that sort of changed the pecking order internally. And then Pettersson struggled massively and they fired Travis Green. And I think from there, you know, you've got sort of like the organizational betrayal, veterans from another organization coming out and really pointing out how silly things were, the terrible season start they got off to with Pettersson struggling massively. Then you have sort of the Bruce There It Is run that kind of papers over some of these emerging fissures for a bit, restores a sense of belief, but the club still can't get it right the next year. They still take a massive step back the next season. Lafair Boudreaux goes down. Finally, you get Talkett in. Finally, it looks like it's all going well. It was a completely joyless team.
Mm-hmm.
It was a joyless team, and fundamentally, they still, in big moments, like with chances to advance to the Western Conference Final, still this group couldn't really put egos aside and work together and partner effectively. And then that submarined another season in which this team reasonably should have been expected to make the playoffs and maybe even make some noise, given sort of what we thought of this group going into last season. And so it's just like there's been organizational failures that I think have enabled...
I think enabled
these fissures to grow.
It's fair to say that the team has not set these players up for success.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? And I think
you've lost too many good guys. You've lost too many Ian Coles. You've lost too many Bo Horvats. You've lost too many Stetchers, Toffolis, Markstrom, Staniffs. You've lost too many guys with weight. You know, you've lost too many guys to keep this on the straight and narrow, or at least to help keep this on the... Kyle Burrows. You know, just like character guys. And that's partly where you get to with this season. So if this team wanted to just be like, you know what, we know that our highest upside guys are necessary. Like, we know our best shot of doing what we want to accomplish on the ice is with Pettersson and Demko in the fold. I understand. But if they're also like, we want to totally revamp how this team feels to be around, I'd also understand. And that's not to point the finger at Demko or Pettersson or to even accept the premise of the source
of the, like, drama diva
of
thing
that PJ talked to. Like, I'm not even accepting that premise. I'm just saying I can understand looking at this group and being like, okay, our best chances with the guys we have here. And I can understand looking at this group and just being like, man, I want something fresh.
Mm-hmm. Because I think it's fair to say, you know, you look the brief history lesson you give there, right, I think is really important context. Because when you hear us talk about, oh, there's a desire for a change of new cast of characters, change of direction, reboot, all of those things, clean slate, it can sound like it's purely a player blame thing, right? Like, these guys have failed. These guys aren't going to get it done. Ship them out of town, right? And I think there's certainly a lot of blame to go around for the predicament and the position that the Canucks find themselves in right now. But I do think it's just important to step back and recognize, whatever you think of these players individually and some of the things, you know, whatever, their track record, their resume, it's fair to say that the organization did not put them in a position to maximize their talents, right? And you think back to when it was a future looking bright with Demko, Hughes, Pettersson, Besser was still here, relatively young. Horvat was still relatively young. JT Miller was here. It just had a fantastic season, you know, coming out of the bubble. Not that it was then guaranteed or it was going to be easy to have that team on an upward trajectory to being a perennial contender, but I think those were legitimate building blocks. No one was fooling themselves for looking at those as legitimate building blocks. And the path from here to there is not just about like those guys failing as individuals. It's about an organizational failure, an organizational failure to put them in a position to succeed, to create the environment where they're going to be at their best, where they're going to be the best professionals, all of those things. So I don't want anyone to interpret it as just saying, oh, those guys screwed up, you know, it was all their fault, anything like that, because it's not. It's that's the job of management, of the organization, is to make sure when you get those guys into your team that you're doing everything you can to get the most out of them as well. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And some people texted in, they're like, well, they're trying to get rid of the drama? Like, what about Jim Rutherford and Patrick Alvin? I mean, I get it. Jim Rutherford has not necessarily made tamping down on the drama a priority. But I also, this is a thing that goes back way before these guys got here, right? Like, I understand the take, but the drama that we're talking about from a player perspective did not begin with the Jim Rutherford and Patrick Alvin era either.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's okay. I think it's okay to have fun doing your job and to be honest to your paying customers. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have a problem with that. So that's just what it is. I don't think it's a problem. Like, it's not an issue to have an issue with your teammate. It's only an issue if it impacts your ability to coexist, right? It's only an issue if you both go out there and publicly deny it and act like it's a stupid question, only for the team to admit it publicly and then trade one of you as a result. You know, like, you can be honest with people and have fun. And I think there's a difference between what sort of Jim Rutherford's candidness looks like, right? And what we're discussing in terms of how a group behaves seems to impact the consistency level of their performance. That's the gap.
That's the show for today. Man, we got into a lot of different things today. Thanks to everyone for listening and texting in. Just before we go, though, of course, I got to tell you, can't find the latest episodes of your favorite HGTV, Discovery, and Food Network shows? Rogers Xfinity TV has the newest seasons of the top-rated shows on these popular channels, while other providers are no longer including them in their TV lineup. If your TV provider doesn't carry these channels, you're missing out on new seasons of Celebrity IOU, Hometown, Beat Bobby Flay, Expedition X, and more. Don't be fooled by other channels pretending to be these networks you know and love. Get the latest with Rogers Xfinity TV at Rogers.com. That's Canucks Talk for today. We're back tomorrow here on Sportsnet 650.